again, I would like to raise some objection to the argument that the war was made for oil. You say that we have to need to find motives for the war, and you also say that the neocons of the PNAC are providing intellectual justifications for the war. But I think it's important to understand how the ideologues like the PNAC, since that's what we are concerned with, function and what's their relation to the broader society. The ideologues, of course, need to provide justifications in terms of the policy in terms of noble goals. I mean, no, there's no society where the ruling class, if you want to use that word, simply says to the people, look, we are going to come and rob you. Even Hitler didn't say that. Even Hitler phrased his policies in terms of noble goals, like freeing Europe from Bolshevism, etc. So we have to understand that these ideologues, if you wish, come up with a noble goal, and I tried to explain this morning what it means to them and what it means to their supporter, and their ideology can have an independent effect, even though the goals cannot be defended and the logic of their argument cannot be defended. It does not mean that their ideology cannot have effects which are relatively independent of what a particular industry like the oil industry would want. You see, I don't see in your argument a very strong case that the oil industry was actually lobbying for the war, for that specific war, and it's not clear to me that the oil industry was overwhelmingly convinced that this would be its interest, and for the time being, it's not its interest at all, because they're not even pumping oil out of Iraq for the moment because of the sabotage of the pipelines. And people anticipated that, and some people were worried about it. I mean, Bush the First is as linked to the oil industry as Bush the Second, and Bush the First was against the war. Baker is also linked to the oil industry, was also against the war. As for the more global capitalists, people like Soros was against the war, and it's against the re-election of Bush, and he's working against that very strongly. So things are quite a lot more complicated, it seems to me, than what you say. I want to finish by making a remark, because I see the defense is having fun, and they think I'm supporting them, and some people are making that remark, but that's not the case.
You are saving us so much time.
No, okay, that's fine. But what I want to say is that when I regard the neocon as a group of fanatical ideologues, I don't consider that as a defense, but as an indictment of them, okay? That's a big difference. I may agree with the defense about the facts, but not about the moral judgment. I think fanatical ideologues are far worse than capitalists who would look for their enlightened self-interest. So I want to emphasize this point, that I think the ideological fanaticism of the neocons plays an independent role, independent of the strictly economic interest of the oil industry. And I think that has to be taken into account. One paper in the set of papers that we receive is by Jeffrey Blankfort, which argues that the war was actually for Israel and was done by people who see, probably wrongly so, but see the elimination of Saddam Hussein and the transformation of the Middle East as essential to the survival of Israel, and that's their motivation, which I would call an ideological motivation rather than a purely economical one. And I think one has to realize that it's very difficult to argue, you know, definitely one way or another, and one shouldn't be dogmatic about these things.
Well, I think in my testimony I made clear it was not only oil. It's the oil industry, the military industries, the construction industries that together, and as represented in the Bush administration, it was the war was in their immediate material interests. The think tanks that exist, and the PNAC is definitely one of them, but there are a whole number, and each of them are kept intellectuals whose purpose is to defend the material interests of particular groupings within U.S. largest corporations, whether it's the insurance or the pharmaceutical, or there's all sorts of think tanks and strategists who are really maintained and financed and very handsomely paid to be spokespeople, to be the writers, the intellectuals, and so on. They're in no way independent. They are a paid role. It's especially important within the United States, though, today to, I think, keep in mind that the military industries and the oil industries are the largest, most profitable, and the dominant corporations, and they are also wholly subsidized corporations, which makes them enormously profitable. They draw endlessly from tax dollars. They don't in any way have to be competitive. And behind each of these corporations are many, many thousands of subcontractors. Now, the Bush administration and the PNAC did not act alone. The U.S. Congress voted overwhelmingly to give President Bush full authority to wage this war. And it was because at the time, ruling circles in the United States, while they had misgivings, while they had worries, while they raised them occasionally and quietly and in editorials, overwhelmingly would have been very happy with the war if Bush and his administration had got away with it. If Iraq were compliant and stabilized today, if there was no crisis, then it would be an entirely different situation. There was a small grouping who, though, had an actual plan, and it is represented in the PNAC. They had a plan that they felt would stabilize and strengthen U.S. imperial power and make it the overriding global power in the world today, able to dismiss even those who were their allies in all past situations, not even feeling they needed to consult with the United Nations or with European powers and forces and so on. So I think that the situation, the PNAC is certainly part of it. They were the actual ideologues scoping out the plan, but it was sold and accepted to the most significant part of the ruling corporate powers in the United States today.
Thank you very much. Do you have some questions among the defense? Don't quarrel among yourselves.
Well, I want to subscribe fully to the remarks of the prosecution initially. Even with respect to fanatical ideologues, I agree with the prosecution, but that's my personal view. I wanted to follow up, though, with some specific examples beyond that cited by the prosecution. First, however, let me salute you for your own work with respect to the divestiture of President Jean-Paul Aristide in Haiti, I mean, with respect to the work that you've done, because I think it's been excellent in alerting people to what took place. With respect, however, to the ruling classes and their general agreement or alleged agreement to the idea of the Gulf War, I wanted to ask you I wanted to challenge you with respect to that, beginning with the oil companies. Are you aware of the report that was issued by the James Baker International Center at Rice University about 9 months before the actual invasion and what its conclusions were? It was issued in a joint report with the Council on Foreign Relations. I would just like to lead with that and then come back to you. Well, the report, as I recall it, said that if the United States insists on invading Iraq, it should do so only on two conditions. The first condition would be that it had the United Nations and a broad alliance similar to that of the Gulf One behind it. And the second condition was whatever it does, it should not seek to take advantage of the oil sector that would be available, theoretically, to it, lest it be seen and understood as a colonial adventure that should be utterly impermissible with respect to any practical U.S. foreign policy in the region. And I was wondering if you could want to comment on that. Also wanted to ask you, if the ruling classes were so much behind the war, why Brent Scowcroft, whose consultancies with many of the same companies, including high technology, electronics, and arms companies, why he should come out in an op-ed, or in several op-eds, in the New York Times, I believe, in the spring of 2002, and indicate his opposition to any war in Iraq under the current circumstances, and go further and call for a U.S. NATO force to essentially impose a settlement in Israel, between Israel and the Palestinians, which would be based largely on the Taba Agreement and the Green Line, and that the U.S. should provide troops for such an effort. And thirdly, if you're acquainted with the series of editorials that were published in Business Week magazine, which I'm sure you will agree is an important magazine, an important mouthpiece for various elements of the business community, a series of editorials and featured columns by people like Jeffrey Garten, which stated that, essentially, this policy of the kind that's supported by PNAC is extremely dangerous to the interests of multinational corporations and should be opposed, and called upon CEOs of major corporations to take the risks of retaliation, of whatever, against the administration, but to speak out privately and, if necessary, publicly against the general trajectory of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, these are important points, because it does show that there was a real debate in U.S. ruling circles as to how to wage the war and how to draw in, if it was possible to draw in, the United Nations, what that would mean in terms of concessions to France and Germany and many other countries. It was really a debate in those terms, not whether to lay hold of the resources in Iraq. And I do think it's true about the statements, of course, of Baker calling for UN role, and there were many voices in the U.S. that called for some wider force for the war. But the question of the war, they weren't opposed to. It was really how to go about waging the war. The question of weapons of mass destruction, they all knew, all of them, and this has come out since. That was simply the public excuse for the war. No one really thought that Iraq was any danger to the people of the world. However, I would not take as good coin a Baker statement saying that the United States should not take advantage of the oil in Iraq. I mean, I would consider that naive public relations statements. What else would Baker be interested in Iraq? And Iraq, in Iraq, it's not only the oil in Iraq. It was a plan to seize and completely remodel Iraq as a way of remodeling the entire region, to build a U.S. embassy in Baghdad of 3,000 people that would be the largest embassy in the entire region, that would give them a regional scope and control. It was about control of Iraq and the region in a way that excluded Europe and Japan and the other competitors and allies of the U.S. in global competition. Now, all of this was very much debated, but one thing that was never under real discussion was, should there be war on Iraq? Every single commentator, every politician that represented any major power in the United States at the time would say again and again, well, of course we have to go in and we have to overthrow Saddam Hussein and we have to have our forces there and we have to remodel Iraq. The only question was whether to do it with allies, which means a piece of the action, a cut, or not. And it really is a material question to them.
Thank you.
Just a point of information. Early in your testimony, you mentioned that Iraq was part of the agenda since 1997, 1998. I don't remember that to be the case, and certainly in the statement of principles, Iraq is not listed. It's only later in the PNAC document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, where that is mentioned. And certainly in the statement of principles, that is not the case, where it's laid out explicitly as in Rebuilding America's Defenses. Concerning...
All right, the point was from 1998, there was a very explicit plan for global domination, excluding all other powers, right? And the right, asserting the right of preemptive war and overwhelming force to accomplish those goals.
I think you may, I may be wrong, but the document called a clean break. The document called a clean break, which was crafted by people who were working for Netanyahu, I think it goes back to 96. And in that document, they already speak of getting rid of Saddam Hussein, but of course, in the interest of Israel. So the link to Israel was clearly stated back in 1996, and I think it's, again, more important maybe than the purely oil question. I mean, for example, when you say Baker, you say it's naive to take Baker at its word, but Baker may think in terms of the global interest of the oil companies, and he may think that the disruption in the situation in Iraq will be disruptive and it may be adventurous and it may not be worth the price, and he may just think as a good representative of the capitalist interest that this is not a good idea to do that. And only fanatical ideologues who are working because they have some vision that the democratic Middle East will be better for the interest of Israel will want the war. I'm not saying that what I just say now is true, I'm just saying it's not so easy to dismiss, that's all.
Tom Barry, you still have something?
Yes, I'm just simply trying to keep to the focus of Project for a New American Century. But since it's been enlarged to the military-industrial oil complex, I have a couple of questions. You say that the military-industrial complex had the most to gain. I think it's important to define what the military-industrial complex is, that as Eisenhower described it, it didn't include as the implication, as I understand the implication of military contractors, it also included the military itself, and indeed large sectors of the military were not in favor of the war. And perhaps you have other information. And then there was a point that you had made about that it was not until September 11th that not until September 11th that weapons of mass destruction were talked about in terms of Iraq, that Iraq did not pose a threat. Indeed, throughout the 1990s, that neoconservatives, the hawks, were talking about threats, particularly threats to Israel from weapons of mass destruction from bases in Iran and Iraq. I just wanted to make that clarification, or perhaps you disagree.
No, I think I shortened a paragraph there, which in the written form here says it more clearly. But the question of the weapons of mass destruction, of course, that was a justification for 12 years of sanctions that killed more than 1 million Iraqis. The endless hunt for the weapons of mass destruction, which in the 91 war, more than 80% of Iraq's military capacity and industrial capacity to produce more weapons was destroyed. And then the first 5 or 6 years of inspections destroyed 90% of the remaining capacity. And this was well known, that Iraq had no further capacity to produce any weapons that presented a threat. But the use of it as an excuse for war reached a whole new crescendo, a whole new justification after 9/11, not only to continue the sanctions, but as a reason for war itself. And that was really the change. I wanted to say something also in terms of Israel, because I don't think we should see it as the tail wagging the dog. You know, global policy isn't set in Tel Aviv, it's set in Washington, D.C. And Israel functions really as the most powerful U.S. base in the entire region. That's its reason for U.S. support as the greatest recipient of foreign aid, more than $15 million a day, every day for the last 50 years, is what the United States has given to Israel. Being from New York, a city of similar population to the country of Israel, if New York City received $15 million a day, of course it would be an entirely different city. But really, the role of Israel has always been to destabilize the region, to justify and continue an endless and reckless arms race. That's extremely important, and that, in turn, it goes directly to the profit of the military corporations and the oil corporations. All of the oil revenue, Saudi Arabia ends up a debtor nation. Where does the money go? It goes right to Boeing for weapons, because their weapons have to match, and they never do, but they buy endless rounds of weapons, and so do all of the oil corporations. And so Saudi Arabia ends up with 60% illiteracy, and now huge and growing unemployment, and a very undeveloped economy. Most of their money has gone into weapons. That is the role of Israel in the region, as a destabilizing force, and a force that, because it's armed by U.S. aid, other countries match it, and it's a very important part of it, although it's longer than what we're talking about today, but I think it's worth looking at, because sometimes when it goes the other way around, we're saying that the United States fought this war for Israel, as if there was concern for Jewish people. That's not what it's about at all. There is a determination to keep Israel as a base to destabilize the area. And it's not a concern for any people in the world today. It's a concern for how to maximize profit.
Has anyone in the commission any question? Yes, Samir?
As usual. Thank you. I'll be very short because I totally agree, and I am very happy that this has been said, that it is not United States supporting Israel or joining plans of Israel. It's Israel which is used by the United States. Israel is useful for the control of the region. That is the reason for supporting it. No other reason. No other reason at all. Therefore, the problem is not, is it oil or is it Israel? Because both are the same. Israel is supported because of the oil in the region, among other things, but also the geographic position, in order to menace China, India, Russia, and to submit Europe to a blackmail. When we are speaking of oil, we should not mean the immediate additional profit of oil companies. This, if it were happening in Congo, would be called nepotism and corruption. It does exist. It has its small importance. But we should look into the plan in the longer run, which is the military control of oil, because there will be a shortage probably of oil within 20, 30, 50 years. And if the United States are able to establish their military direct control of major areas for the production of oil, of course they will not share it equally with the others. They will use it to starve China, to starve other countries from oil, and also to continue submitting Europe to a permanent blackmailing. This is the target. It will additionally bring profit, but the target is beyond the immediate profit, the longer run. And in that respect, oil is very important. Oil, the geographic position, the use of Israel, all those dimensions of the question constitute a whole, a target.
I want to say I very much I agree with each point there. And sometimes oil, it's such a narrow way of looking at it. Iraq itself, before 1991 war, had really and was developing rapidly into an industrial power in the region. And as such, it also represented a threat, and its development under U.S. control an enormously lucrative possibility. The determination to keep the entire Arab world underdeveloped and colonized is what also, when they talk about restructuring Iraq, changing it fundamentally, it's not just privatizing the oil, it is making a fundamental change in all of the social services that once were provided for free in Iraq. Healthcare and education and the very way in which the government functioned that gave the people a lot. That was a very dangerous threat in the entire region because it shows what can be done with oil resources if that wealth is nationalized and used for internal development. So that was also, I think, a real threat and a determination. Iraq had survived 12 years of sanctions, had survived the 12 years of sanctions. And that was what gave a real drive to the Bush administration also, that if they didn't act to completely crush and seize it, that the opportunity might be lost for them. I think that was a calculation on it too.
I would like to ask about even the immediate profit of oil. If you give us some information, right, that will export oil to Iraq, can you just clarify that, whether Israel will export oil to Iraq in the very, very near future? The other thing, this new project called Greater Middle East, deconstruction and restructure of the Middle East that Bush is speaking about.
Well, oil is a resource that you don't know what country it's from once it's in the pipeline. But the control and the marketing of it is, and who controls that marketing on a global scale becomes very important in terms of the control of industry worldwide and markets and many other resources. I think the U.S. military uses so much oil in Iraq that there's literally not people stand in line for cooking fuel or oil, gasoline to run their cars, because you have an enormous number of tanks and all kinds of equipment that is just like a sponge using what is available. That seems impossible in an oil-rich country that there should be these shortages. But it's part of the problem of an enormous military presence with a high-tech and giant supply line that it can create shortages in an oil-rich country. In terms of deconstruction, though, of the entire region, when you look at U.S. control of the other oil-producing states, none of those countries have really developed an economy that is a balanced economy. They are oil exporters exclusively. And when the oil runs dry, they will have nothing. And what Iraq had done with its oil and what Iran is doing with its oil, and the countries that have some control over their resources is trying to develop their own economy. I wanted to say one other thing about how arms and oil are connected, because arms, weapons, are today the U.S. export. And it also is part of what is profitable in the world for U.S. corporate power. When I said these are wholly subsidized corporations, what is the main thing that is imported by many, many countries in the world? What's the main U.S. product? It's not what develops their own country. It's not what develops their own industries. It's overwhelmingly weapons. It's the greatest source of profit in the United States today is from weapons also. And it destabilizes not only Iraq, but the entire world. U.S. forces in 130 countries around the world enforce that. The McDonnell Douglas behind the McDonald hamburgers. It enforces unequal market relations. And I think it's very important looking at that, what was the PNAC plan? It was saying we can get there faster, we can go further by preemptive military force. Forget any political alliances or relationships, we can just bomb our way into control. But it was just one strategy for control. There are other strategies in U.S. ruling circles, and Bush may lose credibility. We have two candidates for office today, and both of them for Iraq, their solution is send in more troops. And this is something that in the United States we really have to deal with, politically also.
If I may make a small comment, I think it was not that Israel is selling oil to Iraq, but that an Israeli oil company is also working now in Iraq.
Yes, investing in. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question with respect to that last statistic. Now, U.S. conventional arms sales in the last period, annual period, were approximately, if I recall correctly, from the CRS report, the Congressional Research Service report, which is based on classified as well as unclassified data, was approximately $10 billion. I don't know the overall exports of the United States, but I do know that last year the trade deficit was on the nature of more than $300 billion. And I'm wondering where you get your assertion that U.S. arms were the biggest export currently of the United States, because that just doesn't tally with my understanding of, like, food, I believe, is a much, much larger, is in the tens of billions of dollars. So I'd like to, if you have the citation, I'd be obliged. If you don't have it available, if you could submit it later, I'd be obliged.
Yes, all right, I will. The figure was actually sales and aid, which together make up a much more substantial than, but aid is another form of a sale because it leaves a country indebted.
But I have to say that would only be, from the State Department budget, that would be about $4 billion. And you can about triple it on the Pentagon side. But we're still talking on the order of between $20 and $30 billion. And I still would be surprised, but I would be very open to being corrected about that. Thank you.
I ask Sami Amin to give some.
Well, I think the question was not correctly asked, because one has to look at the balance of trade between exports and imports for each branch of industry. If you look at each branch of industry of the United States, all of them, except armament, are in deficit. That is, the branch even of high-tech, which was positive into the benefit of the United States around $35 billion 10 years ago, is now in a small deficit, around zero or under zero. For the conventional, traditional industries, a huge imbalance, deficit. For agricultural products, a huge deficit also. For every branch of industry, except armament. That is, this is why, even if you have only 10 billion exports of armament, you have still 500 million of deficit overall, because the deficit of the other branches is far larger. I can provide the exact figures I have given.
Thank you very much, Guido Habe.
When I came here this morning, I was worried and concerned. I'm listening to this discussion, I'm even more worried and concerned. But let me tell you why. That a country power like the United States wants to control the flow of oil, it's logical, you know, it's rational. It's not moral, but it's rational. That they want to use Israel, Israel wants to use them, it's, again, rational. No, absolutely. But what worries me more and more is that there seems to be an element that escapes us, something irrational, that even against their direct interests, they might come to certain foreign policies or decisions. And when I read and reread the PNAC statement, the PNAC statement, there's something delusional about it, something almost frightening about it. You know, just that it's more than just a rational grabbing of power. And my question is, am I totally paranoid? Thank you.
I suppose that a specialist in psychology should have to answer that, but anyway.
But no, I would agree with that. It is delusional because it's looking only at the military equation. So you have the Wolfowitz, the Rumsfeld mentality that says the United States has more weapons than the whole rest of the world put together. They're far more powerful. We have the delivery systems. Who can stand in our way? And part of the calculation is not at all in their thinking that people's movements to resist colonial occupation can be enormously powerful and creative. And in this day and age, also skilled with high ability of technique. I mean, in Iraq, they don't have any high-tech weapons such as the United States have, but they seem to be able to do things with, as they say, garage door openers and cell phones and all kinds of things that are able to and bring down Apache helicopters with weapons that are not so advanced. But it's because there's a whole population behind that resistance, and this has been true again and again. It's something that France found, it's something that Britain found in the past in Algeria and Vietnam, and we could, but today the United States felt their weapons were so sophisticated before the war, it was unending. I don't know what it was like anywhere else, but in the United States, pages of the newspaper every day would be describing these high-tech weapons, how robots could see around corners and they could read license plates from cars, from a satellite. And it was so powerful that you did feel great, an enormous fear. Who could stand in the way of that? And the shock and awe that they described and then carried out, it would seem that any resistance would be impossible. And yet, everyone in the world today can see what's happening, and it is creating a crisis in U.S. ruling circles. I'm sure of that, although I don't have yet the documents on that, but the level of debate, even in the media, they really think, how did we get into this? And every time a tank or a helicopter goes down around the world, people take note of that. And that also weakens U.S. power in a way that they never thought possible. That's what I mean where I say it wasn't in Rumsfeld's plan, that this happening again and again and on TV, and they can scream about Al Jazeera shouldn't be in Fallujah, but Al Jazeera is in Fallujah. And as something happens, it's shown to the world. Anyway, I'm just saying the political equation they didn't take into account.
Thank you. We have a last question. Denis Hallyday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank Sarah for being here and demonstrating that standing up helps jet lag. You seem to be doing very well. And perhaps if I may presume to say that perhaps all of us here would like to have you send a message to Ramsay Clark that we very much miss him. But you, without him, are hot stuff, nevertheless. But you've raised issues that are very interesting. I put it your way. I've been for years saying that Saddam Hussein should have got a percentage on arms sales from the United States, because his presence, phonyly dangerous though we knew it to be, but it was stirred up by Rumsfeld and the boys and what have you, and Albright before the girls, before the boys took over. But the fact is, as you said, that market is now going to decrease significantly. The need to buy weapons in anticipation that Saddam Hussein is going to break out and threaten somebody, even maybe Kuwait, which we know was not in fact the reality, that those days are over. So the plan perhaps was privatization of the Iraqi economy. It was going to make money for American corporations to compensate for the losses from the arms sales industry, and as they're all so closely related, maybe one would compensate for the other. But that also now looks like it ain't going to work, because the Iraqis are not rolling over. They don't seem to be too wedded to the idea of this permanent occupation, whether it's economic or military or both. Something has gone seriously wrong here. So we're seeing the PANAC successfully driving this ideology through Mr. Bush and his regime, and now we're beginning to see that when it doesn't work, something else is happening, which as a commission of inquiry, we may need to look at that side too. Maybe you have some reaction to that. Thank you.
I think that's such a good point, because part of the privatization of Iraqi industry was based on the expectation they would stabilize Iraq, but also chart its destiny for decades into the future. So this huge surplus of oil wealth, what would it be spent on? Not the needs of the Iraqi people. With it would buy a whole new generation of jet aircraft, it would be sales for Boeing. The contracts, very little of this reconstruction money has even hit Iraq. It goes as far as the corporations, the money goes right in, they send a few contractors, but it really is like a huge slush fund. By privatizing Iraqi industry, not just oil, but all of the industries, and also controlling the Iraqi bank. It's a former U.S. Treasury official who's head of the National Bank of Iraq. The entire country was put in their hands, along with billions of in the oil for food program and in frozen assets around the world. That all went into U.S. hands. That was a big chunk of money also, a big chunk. I think also there was a calculation of fear on their part that to totally control Iraq and be able to stabilize it would stabilize them in the region, because they are fearful of growing instability in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, where the population also more and more hates them, and they were looking for a decisive win to change their situation. And instead, the opposite is happening. And I think that is also ruling circles in the U.S. are worrying about that increasingly, the instability in the whole region beyond Iraq, when they talk about Iraq being a center now for resistance. I think that's what they're worried about, others taking that example.
Thank you very much, Sarah Flounders.